something in relation to your faith is you discern. And so for me, having a model where I can put things in categories and like think it through systematically helps me with choosing. So that's what I'm going to offer today. It's like a lens. It's like somebody that I know who can do art says that when you try and draw a picture of something, you don't just like look at the landscape. You have to have a frame that you use in order to crop the scene so that you can choose what you're going to paint or draw. Or like in a camera, you've got a viewfinder that you look through in order to take the photograph. Yeah? So that's what a model does. It simplifies it a little bit. It's a reflection of reality, but it isn't reality. It's an artificial construct that you put on top of reality to help you think about it a little bit more clearly and make choices. Every model has limitations. And one of the things about doing this work for me in teaching over the last like 5 or 6 years as I've been thinking about it is that every time I tell it to people, people tell me things that make me change it and help me make it better. And so I always tell people when I present this, this is now, it'll be yours at the end of this class. It doesn't belong to me. I'm giving it to you. If it helps, use it. If you need to shift it, shift it. And if not, then put it in the rectangular blue file. But even the act of saying, oh, this model doesn't quite work in this way, even that helps to sharpen our perceptions. You know, I'm looking at Holly. Like when you're writing something, Holly, even saying that is not the right word, it helps you to find what is the right word. Yeah. So that's what models do for us. So I've got a model for you. And I couldn't do it on a board because we don't have one. But I've got a handout with colours. I'm so proud of myself. I sat at my desk with coloured marks. And so the model is of a washing line, which is a very English thing. In the trade, in education, it's called a continuum model. You know, it's a line with different places along it where you can look and see what it would be like to be in one of those places. So I'm going to talk you through it, and we'll walk along the washing line, and we'll look at other things around it, and ask questions as we go, and I'll give you examples as we go along. And you can see I can't draw socks to save my life. But I know you know what they are. So you start at the far left end with what is called charity. Which generally in most people's mind involves giving money, writing a check, yeah? And quite often that is not viewed as a particularly great way of social engagement. Now what I want to say right from the start, I want you to look at the words that are down the left-hand washing line thing. Shallow or deep engagement. Any of these places along the line can be a good place. Any of these places can be the right place for you to stand as an individual or as a group. And any of those places, you can engage with that activity in a way that is less deep or more deep. So, charity. If you are a community of faith that is relatively affluent, relatively financially privileged, in an area geographically that doesn't have a whole lot of other people who are less affluent and privileged in it, charity is really important. As a Christian in that situation, a wealthy Christian in a in a privileged setting, it is important that you be parted from your money, because it's good for your soul. Yeah? And it can be done in ways that are really automatic. I've known congregations and they've got this outreach committee, and every year they write the same checks to the same groups and nobody thinks about it. I know another congregation that said, we're going to do this differently. We still need to be giving money. That's clearly part of what God is calling us to do. But we're going to take our outreach allocation, we're going to divide it by 12, and every month, somebody in the congregation will be able to make a pitch for an organization that they're involved with. They'll have to write a little article for the bulletin. They'll have to do a little presentation at coffee hour. They'll have to have a table with information on it. And people will find out more about that organization. That's taking charity to a much, much more formative level. And over the time, the congregation has really built relationships with some of the groups that they previously just wrote a check to. I'm looking at Lisi. Writing checks is a great thing to do, right?
I mean, like it,
yeah.
So when there's a space, if you'll give me 20 seconds to talk about a variation of that we did, but finish.
Yeah. No, that's fine, because that's the charity bit that's finished. So please give an example.
Back several years ago, the approach that this congregation took was that we identify groups within the community that somebody in the congregation was actively involved in.
Mm-hmm.
And we identified groups that had opportunities both to, just like we asked members to give both of their time and of their money, the organizations had space for, they loved to accept checks, but they had opportunities to volunteer,
yeah,
or to get involved.
Right, right.
And so, and then we did the same thing. We had a table with information,
yeah,
and we built relationships. And so that,
sure.
It was a relational-based,
yeah,
version of that.
Right, and then people have
so
stories.
In case people are asking, well, what has St. Gregory's done?
Yeah, that's really
that's
cool.
That's our most recent
one. Sure, right. And Paul said I'd tell you about Episcopal Community Services. So this is like part of my personal journey with this charitable organization. In case you don't know, it was founded by the Episcopal Church. It's now the biggest direct service provider for people who are experiencing homelessness in San Francisco. It runs shelters, it runs NAV centers, it builds buildings, it does workforce training and all of that stuff.
What is its name?
Episcopal Community Services. Anyway, and I'd always like given money. It had been like on the automatic checklist of our charities because I'm an Episcopal priest, it's an Episcopal organization, why wouldn't I? Then one day there was an article in the paper about the new idea for navigation centers, which is the intensive, much more hands-on help for people who are really experiencing acute homelessness to be taken off the streets and able to take all of their gear and their dogs and not be separated from their partners and have intensive intervention to get them into housing. And my husband and I read that and we thought, that's a really good idea and it might not work, because the article was really clear. It was an experiment. And we thought, you know, people might not be willing to give to that because it's not proven, but we really want to have a part in it. So we gave more to that. And so my relationship with the institution started to deepen a little bit. I started to get to know the executive director who was running it, and I went to visit a NAV center and saw what they were doing and educated myself about it and got to know more. So that's a personal example of it. But what Lisi said is really important, because you described what I call rightward creep along the washing line. And that's a really good symptom, as it were. If you've been engaging in charity and you've been going deeper, then you're likely to creep to the right towards what I call hands off. And there are two socks, because it can be short-term or long-term stuff.
Why not those wear boots?
Well, no, because you don't put boots on a washing line, but maybe they can be boot socks or something.
Uggs.
If they get wet, yes. Anyway, the Uggs on the washing line. So, I mean, think about a story. Think about a suburban congregation, and the local fire station is collecting school supplies for kids at the beginning of the year. And the congregation collects the supplies and gives them, and somebody writes a check as well, that's in the charity line. And the hands-off is, you know, they take it to the fire station and drop it off. There's really no personal connection there, but it's an activity. It's more than writing a check. It's collecting stuff, but it's very much kind of hands off. That can be shallow or deep too. There's a wonderful congregation in New York City that observed a real gap in the provision of food for food insecure people. They learned that towards the end of the month, a lot of people needed help with just a couple of meals or two. And so they decided that what they would do is create bags that had shelf-stable meals in them, using dry goods and canned goods and stuff. And they did the research and put together a nutritionally balanced kit, as it were. And they pack them corporately as a congregation. They all get together like every quarter, and more than 100 people come, and they spend the morning packing, and they sing, and they wear t-shirts, and then they take them to the food banks all around Manhattan, so that they sit on the shelf, so that at the end of the month, if somebody comes in, they can just reach off and give them one. And they also design the meal so it can be cooked like in a microwave, so that people who are living in SROs. That's a really good example of hands-off social engagement done really well, especially because they can involve their children and youth in the activity, and it can be formational. They do it together. They start with prayer. They sing while they work. They finish with prayer. It's you know, people say, oh, you know, that kind of stuff. You know, it's really doing good, and it's really doing good to the congregation. So think about that congregation that's been collecting up backpack stuff, and they've been doing it for a few years, and they've been dropping it off. And then they decide that they're going to start participating at the fire station in putting together the backpacks. And so that's a bit like the congregation in New York, yeah? And so they start doing that. And maybe only a few of them do it. More people do the collecting and the giving, but a few of them feel called to actually do the assembly. And then some of them decide that they're going to go to the event where the kids receive the backpacks. And they're going to help with that big like party that the fire station puts on. They're going to serve juice and cookies. And they start to get to know the kids and their families in their neighborhood. And it's starting to shift towards hands-on, which is much more relational. It actually involves human touch. And it becomes an annual thing. They do it every year. And they begin to think about these kids because it's a neighborhood school. And then one year, a newcomer comes to the congregation, and it turns out it's the assistant principal at that school. And they say, you know, I know you guys do the backpack thing. We're having like a read-a-thon with the kids to raise money, and we need adults to come and have the kids read to them, and they're going to be sponsored to do the reading. And the congregation says, well, you know, yeah. I mean, this school is in our patch. We've been doing this for a while. And a group of people, probably a different group than do the backpack thing, discern that they're going to do the readathon. It's a one-off, so we're into now hands-on short-term. And they show up, and the kids read to them. And in conversations over coffee hour with the assistant principal, they begin to learn that the kids really need reading tutors. And so they start a long-term ministry in the congregation where people discern that they're called to be in the school every week reading with the kids. So here we are, you know, right at the end of the hands-on long-term stuff. Now, all of the ministries on this side are not designed to change the status quo. The situation of the children is the same. They have a wonderful reading experience. The people who get the ready meals in New York City, they're still food insecure, but they've been helped. This is what I would probably call ministries of loving service that don't change the status quo. But imagine that congregation with the reading group, and they start to think about the children in that school, not as those children, but as our children. There's like a shift from a them to a we because of the relationships. And then there's a ballot initiative that is going to drastically cut funding for some crucial program at that school. And the congregation, led by the people who've been involved in the hands-on and the hands-off and the giving, cross that line. And they cross into a ministry that is trying to change the status quo for those kids. They move into activism initially, which is response to a single issue and mobilizing to do something about it. And so they are saying, these are our children. They go with the parents, with the teachers to City Hall, they lobby, they do some creative thing, they have a read-in in the rotunda at City Hall. You know, whatever it is, they're protesting. They make a dramatic activist thing. They get to know the parents of those children, many of whom may be recent immigrants. Maybe it's English as a second language funding that's being cut. And they shift from activism to advocacy, which is a more long-term involvement in the issues that these families, which have become part of the we of the congregation, are facing. Yeah? And then one of the congregational leaders learns about a community organizing group that brings together institutions like their church around grassroots issues in the community, one of which is the cutting of the funding in the school and the provision of second language study for the kids. Or it might be the fear of some of the families that they're going to be deported and taken away by ICE. And the congregation discerns that as a collective, they're called to join with other institutions in the community to work together.
One thing I notice about the story you're telling is that at no time did the church decide we need to make our membership more diverse and we need to invite people to come to church.
Right, but probably this is a made-up story, and it's a pretty nice, I mean, I can make it really nice because I made it up. But it's good to have a good story because it helps you imagine, like Paul said. I mean, imagine what it would be like. But I can imagine that people in that school might start coming to the church.
Maybe so, but it's not the point.
No, it's not the point. No, it's not. The point is to turn towards neighbors. It's not like an ulterior thing. It's like, we need more diverse people in this church. It's like, we need to turn towards our neighbors with the gospel. And, our neighbors are more diverse than we are. We are getting to know them. They're getting to know us. Maybe the kids want to come to the Christmas pageant and be welcomed. Maybe there'll be a folk camp in the summer. Maybe there'll be a thing that is in the church building that helps the kids keep their reading up during the summer. You know, and all of these things emerge organically, because people are doing the prayer and the discernment individually and collectively. I would imagine that this congregation would get better over time at talking with each other, not just about this cluster of ministries, but somebody would be willing to say at coffee, you know, I've been involved actually for years in this ministry over here, and it's really changed my life, and it's really deepened my faith. So what I find helpful about the model is that it allows for an ecosystem, as Paul was talking about in his sermon today, an ecosystem of action and reflection and discernment that is unique and provides a whole lot of different places kind of in the garden to cultivate things, and a whole lot of different ways in which people can be involved in the garden. Because somebody who is, for example, not able to come to church because they are confined to their home by a chronic illness will be able to pray for those ministries. And somebody who retires, like I'm about to do. I mean, I've been getting more involved with ECS. I've done some dinner serving, for example. You know, you can serve dinner in the shelter. That's a really easy in, and I've done that several times. Then I got asked to serve on the board. So I've done a bit of board work, and particularly helping the organization move into a bigger position in the city, because we're the biggest provider. The city really relies on ECS to do a whole lot of its work for it. We get most of our budget is federal money funneled through the city, and we run the programs on behalf of the city. What that is meaning, though, now is that we're saying, okay, now we need to have a seat at the policy table. When the agencies and the city departments and the homeless SAR gather to talk about budget, to talk about sharing of data, to talk about prioritizing, ECS can now say, we need to have a seat at the table. And the board has been working on that, and so I've been moving into that role. As I retire, I'm going to do more of that. And, you know, if I were a younger person, and, I mean, there is somebody on the board who's just had a baby, who's backed off. She's on sabbatical now from the board. But she and her family still come and serve dinner periodically. So the thing that I like about this is that it's a sort of fluid and various model to help you think individually and collectively about what you might do, what God might be calling you to do. Yeah, Holly.
Could you talk more about the other dimension?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, shallow or deep is really whether it's something that you think about or whether it's something that you just do. The things in our Christian life can be formative if we do them and we think about why we do them, and we think about, like we do after the sermon on Sundays, where we tell stories having just heard the gospel and we talk about what we've been doing. Or they can be just something we do, which they can then tend to be just like one more damn thing that we do or that we feel that we have to do. But as an educator, I suppose my instinct is always to try to give something more value. I mean, like coffee hour here, that's not an outreach ministry really, but it is a way that we turn towards our friends and our visitors. It could be just one damn thing that we have to do every week. You know, provide food, and it's a chore. But in this congregation, the coffee hour is a joy, and people bring their best, and they take delight in serving food. It's gone deeper, and it's part of who we are because it's part of how we're fed at the table of communion, and so the visual sign of putting the coffee on the table also helps. Yeah.
Is the idea that any of these can be shallow or deep?
Yeah, any of them.
Okay.
Any of those places along the line can be shallow or deep.
And
yeah.
My question is, why are shared basic human values deeper than foundational?
Oh, no. That's a different thing. I'm coming to that.
Okay.
I'm coming to that. Because this is only a two-dimensional piece of paper, unfortunately. And it's really limited. What I really want is like a model, you know. Because ideally, those three yellow dotted lines that you see, they're kind of on the ground. So when you're working on these kind of outward-facing ministries and you're doing it with your own Christian community, then it's really clear what motivates you. It's your foundational Christian theology and commitments. And you can talk about it, like I just did about coffee hour. Like the Eucharistic table of fellowship and feeding in this place undergirds the way that we do coffee hour and we reach out to our visitors and guests and to each other. And that's fine, because that's our shared vocabulary, as it were. If we were doing interfaith work, for example, if we were involved in a ministry in the community with other Christians, but with a Muslim group or a Jewish group, we would have to speak more broadly religiously. You know, we would have to talk about God's dream of flourishing for the creation. We probably wouldn't talk so much about Jesus or Eucharist, because that's really specific to our community. So we try to find broad categories that we could share that are the support for what we do together. And then, if you're doing work, say you're doing advocacy work with some churches, but also with the teachers' union, to go back to the school issue, if the teachers' union has gotten involved in that advocacy, or another secular group that has no religious vocabulary, then you find shared basic human values. And that's what you talk about as you do this together. So it's like, you know, when it's us talking about this stuff, we can be like full-on Christian if we want to. But if we're working with people who are from all kinds of faiths and none, then we're looking for the kind of expansiveness of human values that Christians share. Yeah.
For the benefit of those who didn't hear your sermon sharing in the first service, can you tell people about the experience of the young woman whom you brought to the food pantry on Friday?
Yeah, sure. I sent her. I didn't bring her. My husband's niece. No, she came on the bus all by herself. She came on the bus. Yeah, I made her come on the bus. My husband's niece is staying with us for a number of weeks. She's 18 years old, and she's taking a gap year and seeking some direction in her life, and she's traveling. And one of the things I offered her, and a whole lot of things that I sent in a big email, because I wasn't going to have her lying around the house all day, was the opportunity to do some volunteer work. And I mentioned St. Gregory's, and she said last Monday, "I'd like to do some of that volunteer work you talked about." And I said, "Great, then Friday, you're up, you're looking for Randall. You know, this is how the food pantry worked." I showed her the video that's on the website so she could get a sense, and she was like, "Oh, that looks kind of interesting." So, but she's not from a Christian family. She's probably been in a church twice in her life. But she came up, she was welcomed. Peggy welcomed her particularly nicely. And she experienced something here that contributed to the project that she's involved in, which is broadening her experience and broadening her mind. She comes from rural Devon, which, as she says, is one of the whitest counties in England. And she said, "Everybody thought I'd really freak out in San Francisco and have like a nervous breakdown because it's so different, but I haven't." She said, "It's actually amazing. And it's so much more interesting, and I really love it." And she's actually been really brave. But she said, "I noticed how welcoming everybody was here. And it didn't feel like you were just like handing out food. It felt like real hospitality. And I just had never seen anything like it before." Her curiosity was piqued, and yet all that she saw about Christianity was the mural around. What she saw was Christian people and non-Christian people working together for the common good, turning to face their neighbors. But it began a little stirring in her heart.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's what I meant. So, what else did I want to say? The big shift in here, I think, is from ministries that are seen as being done to and with them and with us. The move towards the us and making the circle of our us or our we larger and more embedded in the wider community. And again, that can happen on an individual level or on a corporate level, and especially in a congregation like this, where it's hard because we all come from different places. It's not like we all walk to church from the Potrero Hill South Market neighborhood. If we did, if we were that congregation, I don't know what we could do in this. I mean, we could transform this neighborhood if we actually, if everybody lived here. We'd be like a force to be reckoned with. But we are a force to be reckoned with still in terms of the food pantry. But we can also like have groups of friends, you know, people in the East Bay who might be involved in something together in their neighborhood. You know, people who maybe just have a friend, a co-worker, who might not even be a member of this congregation, but that they do something in terms of facing outwards in love, in service, in advocacy, in justice together. So the permutations are endless. The trick is the intention and the discernment. And it's like, this isn't rocket science, but we tend to forget. And because the opportunities are so many, the needs are so great, and the situation is so complicated, sometimes something like this can help us like get clear in our mind. Okay, where do I stand? What am I doing? Where might I want to be? How might I get there? How come my friends at church help me? Think it through, talk about it at coffee hour. So that practice of discernment is really, really important. So, you know, the example of Episcopal Community Services, you know, people give money, people collect Christmas gifts. That's a hands-on short-term, it can be hands-on or hands-off. It can be a hands-off short-term because they post a list of what the people in the shelter need to have for Christmas. And you can buy it and you can drop it off. Or you can take part in the party where people get their gifts. You can serve meals and therefore get into conversation with people who are living in the shelters. You can do tutoring and coaching for people who are in the workforce development areas, and that's more of an ongoing relationship. You can do board work that moves into justice and advocacy with the city. And as a congregation, I hope that we can know ECS better. And so when there is an issue in the city that we're trying to take a stand on as the Episcopal Community Service Group, we might be able to call on our congregations to stand with us. You know, I don't know what that might be, but it might be, there might be an occasion where the city budget really needs to be changed, you know, and if citizens who are Christians, who are Episcopalians, who see Episcopal Community Services as our way, as a denomination of helping in the city, can stand with, then that's really cool. The other opportunity at the moment, and this is a shameless pitch, so I'll just make it. And then I'll stop. It's really exciting. You know the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals building on Mission at 7th? Behind it, there's a parking lot that is surplus to requirements. The federal government has sold it to San Francisco for $1 with the condition that permanent supportive housing be built on it. Episcopal Community Services partnered with Mercy Housing, and we got the contract for the build. Ground will be broken next month. There will be 260 housing units on that site for the most acute, highest need people. 100 of them will be reserved for seniors. And it'll be people who've been on the streets for the longest, with the most complicated combinations of factors that have been impacting their life. So it's the biggest new build ever in San Francisco. We're doing it with Mercy. They're really good at the building bit. They'll back off as it comes on stream, and we'll do the running of it. At street level, there will be a social enterprise. There has to be, because of the way that the city and federal money comes. And our social enterprise will be the chefs program. So it's the workforce development program. It's called Conquering Homelessness Through Education in Food Service. And we do an 8-week basic certification course to get people ready to go work in a kitchen, commercial kitchen. It's been really successful. It's been running kind of quietly for probably more than 10 years now. But it's been really hampered because the only places the people have to do their training are the shelter kitchens. And it's kind of scattered all over the place. And we haven't been able to build the program to full strength. This building will mean that we'll have a teaching kitchen on Mission Street, facing the street, with, you know, offices for the lead chef, with lockers for the students, with a big kitchen and with space that we can run a social enterprise catering business as well. So that people who go through chefs, some of them finish and they can get a job in a restaurant kitchen or an industrial kitchen right away. Some of them aren't able to do that yet, so they could have transitional employment in our catering business. That piece of it, we have to build ourselves because there's no federal money for it. So we have to raise that money ourselves. And my dream, this is on the charity end of things, my dream is that every single Episcopal church in San Francisco will contribute something collectively to that project. So that all of us can say, ECS is us. It was founded in the basement of Grace Cathedral when they put out cots for homeless people. You know that, right? But that everybody, every Episcopal church in San Francisco, however little they can give or however much, is invested in this particular build-out project. So I'm kind of getting myself mobilized to go around and like preach and do the pitch and tell people. I mean, it's like, what is not to like? It's a successful program. It needs more space. It's a way to have the people who walk past on Mission Street see formerly homeless people learning a skill and a trade, and building the catering business that they are building up. So,
is the chef's part of the project needs need to raise money?
Yeah, the chef's part.
So
the whole chef's kitchen that we're building. Yeah, right. Yeah, there are plans, and it's going to be really beautiful and lovely.
What's your budget that you're looking for?
I knew you'd ask that, and I should have brought up a whole
That's
thing.
That's okay, just more or less.
Yeah, I'm trying to think.
5 million?
I want to say it's probably $1.5 million.
Yeah.
And we're pretty close. I mean, we're going to public phase now, so a lot of the big gifts are in.
Okay.
But when you get in a capital campaign, when you get to the last bit, that's when everybody is like all in kind of giving at that stage, which means that everybody can feel like there's an investment. I can bring stuff and will bring stuff to this congregation. I need to set up a table. That's what I need to do. Yeah, Lisa.
Two cool things about chefs. One is a member of our congregation, Efrain Wahab, has been a teacher.
Oh, right, she has, yeah.
So if you want, I don't think she's done it for a while, but yeah. She has done it fairly recently. If you want more information about what that's like, you can talk with Efrain. So we already have that connection with the chef's program. And the other thing I'm thinking, and it's more in general, and I don't know how this goes with the new rules that you can't ask people, you can't have a box that says you have a felony conviction, but food service has traditionally been one of the very few entry points into the workforce where somebody with a criminal record a felony, where the person has served her time, can get a job.
Right.
You know, that construction, there are a couple of others. And so it's really, really I mean, I think it's extra important as an entry point into the workforce.
Right. And actually, one of the new federal grants that we've just got in a completely different and new program is a grant to partner with some other institutions to work directly with people who are just coming out of the prison system so that they don't immediately fall into homelessness as soon as they get out, but that we work with them before so that they get placed somewhere, so that they are housed and sheltered as they leave prison, as a strategy to prevent recidivism. Because when people come out of prison and they've got nowhere to go and all their old friends are on the street, where else are they going to go?
And they can't get Section 8 housing.
And they can't get Section 8 housing and.
Often they can't reunite with their families.
Right, I know, yeah. And the parole system makes it really hard, frankly, to get housed, yeah.
City College has a wonderful culinary program where they teach pastry and mm-hmm. all stuff, and it's three blocks away from, it's on Mission and 4th.
Oh.
It's a building in City College on the corner. They have a restaurant where they try things out, and then underground, because I took a cheese class there once.
Right.
Underground, they have some amazing culinary kitchens.
Oh.
Just telling you in case, logistically, if there's any kind of share thing.
Right, or if people from our chef's program want to do another course, that would be a great place for them to go because it's like no cost or low cost.
Right.
Yeah, fabulous. This, it's time, I'm being told. But this kind of connection is what I mean. That's what the washing line actually can help you do, because it shapes the way that you think about it. Thanks so much, guys, and I hope that was helpful.